speculation by assuming that the order parameter here is also highly anisotropic, so sensitive against alloying with ordinary potential scatterers. And we have chosen germanium on silicon side. That's isoelectronic, but bigger in size than silicon. And I compare the following, the results of two of these germanium-doped xenon copper to silicon to single crystals with 10 and 25% with these old data on the undoped material. And you see the 25% germanium doped sample is not superconducting. Apparently, we were able here by deliberately reducing the quasi-polygonic parts to make it shorter than the superconducting coherence length in the whole pressure range, and so unconventional superconductivity cannot form. Anyway, germanium is bigger than silicon, so we expand the average unit cell volume, and that allows us to study on the recoupling side the existence range of what I call the A phase. This interferomagnetic, that's your question, this interferomagnetic deordered phase in greater detail. We can, however, compensate for this alloying-induced volume expansion by applying external hydrostatic pressure. In particular, we have to apply a critical pressure, PC1, to get rid of interferomagnetic order. This critical pressure is, of course, increasing with increasing germanium concentration. So for 10%, it is 1.5 GPa. For 25%, it's 2.4 GPa. We have subtracted this from the applied pressure. That is, we normalize our phase diagram to the magnetic quantum critical point. We compare here samples with the same unit cell volume, but very different values of the mean field path. And you see the mean field path has almost no influence on the magnetic properties. The data for these two samples lie in the same phase boundary, but has influence on the superconducting properties. For the 10% sample, now we find superconductivity well below the TC of the undoped material, so superconductivity is strongly weakened, and existing only in this, under this little dome. So this phase diagram for the 10% doped sample is very similar to that of serum palladium to silicon 2, which I showed you before, and of many other of the serum-based superconductors.
The TC has been rescaled between the two plots, or it's the same scale?
It's the same scale.
Quick question. So for the 25% sample, mm-hmm. this TNAL, which is below the superconducting dome, but this is in the situation where there is no impact superconductivity.
There's no superconductivity.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So there is...
No. So you, this already too much of alloy. Yeah. So you see, it's similar to the generic behavior of the non-Fermi liquid serum-based superconductors.
A related question is for the 10% there is TC that's showing up below the nail temperature at the sample.
But at the same time, we do not know whether it's expulsion of superconductivity or
that's coexistence. That's a separate issue, but nonetheless, TC
but
is
it's still, you see the let me see, the data points here. I'm not sure.
Is any shifting?
I'm not sure whether we saw magnetism in the superconducting state. We did not apply an overcritical field. So that's all of the data Fritzsche Young found in his spreadsheet. He had not a magnet for his measurement.
This seems like there's two issues. It sort of relates to what we heard 2 weeks ago from Joe Thompson on these CNN-115 systems. Namely, one is for a given sample at a given pressure, is there like a two-stage transition first into NDP or MAN set, and second into CP connecting. And then there's a separate issue, which is once you go below TC, whether there's a coexistence of the MAN.
So when we go into our discussions, I have more data and be on the computer. We do have this case. We have the two-step. It's the AS type samples where we have a clear, and I'll show you one maybe at the end of the talk. And we have the coexistence range. We have both at the same time. So the other one is first A phase, and secondly, a first order superconnecting transition under which the A phase is expelled from the volume. So we have both situations depending on the strength of the copy in the undoped material. But this has not been explored as a function of magnetic field, so I cannot tell you. So, but in contrast to all the other cerium palladium to silicon two type materials, what we find here when we increase the pressure is a second superconnecting dome at higher pressure. And this apparently coincides with a weak valence transition of cerium between a more trivalent cerium at lower pressure and a more mixed valent, I mean cerium between 3 and 4 plus on the high pressure side. This is this dashed thin line, which has been found in Japan some years, 3 years ago, by Onuki's group on cerium copper to germanium to the end compound of this alloy series. So let me include the data for cerium copper to germanium 2 into this plot. This is TC as a function of pressure by Jacquard in Geneva on cerium copper to germanium 2. To match it with our data, we have to subtract a rather large critical pressure for the end compound, 11.5 GPa. That has been done. And you see the maximum of TC and the pressure at which the valence transition occurs almost coincide. The valence transition means it's a first order change, reduction of the volume without any change of the symmetry, of the crystal symmetry. It's called the Kondo volume collapse, and is known from elemental cerium, the gamma to alpha transition. And the interesting result of this synchrotron X-ray diffraction work by the Onuki group was that the critical endpoint of this first order gamma to alpha phase boundary is rather low lying. They see this only at 10 Kelvin, but not at higher temperature. So we haven't done the corresponding measurements yet for these germanium doped cerium copper to silicon two samples. This is preparation, but assume we would find the same, namely, first of all, the valence transition coinciding with the peak of this maximum of this TC line, and secondly, a low-lying endpoint. Then we could speculate or dream of some critical fluctuations sufficiently soft, namely charge fluctuations, valence fluctuations or charge fluctuations. And Miyake has come out with a theory 2 or 3 years ago that these extended charge fluctuations could be instrumental to form Cooper pairs as well. So at the moment, let me summarize at that point by deliberately reducing the quasi-parting mean field path, we were able to separate these two different existence ranges, and at the moment we assume or we speculate that the superconnectivity under these two domes is of different origin and that the mechanisms are both unconventional mechanisms, namely heavy quasi particles are formed by the exchange of virtual spin fluctuation of the spin density at low temperature and of the charge density at high temperature.
Question for clarification, going back to previous transparency again, what happens with nail temperature when x is 0?
Here? When x goes to 0?
Yeah.
Oh, let me see. For this phase diagram, we had to assume that the critical pressure for the undoped material is a small finite value. It's 0.4 GPa, 4 kilopascals. But you see, I showed you the generic phase diagram. It's really depending on where you start. We have A-type samples with almost no superconnectivity, other ones where it coexists with spin density wave, and if you go to the S-type samples, we have no A phase anymore. So it depends. And the reason is the copper content. It's the copper concentration is really determining the ground state in that part. So for these, the master system for the alloys, I mean, the stuff from which we formed the alloys by putting germanium. This sample had a critical pressure for 4 kilovolts in this. That's a PC1 for the 0% germanium.
I have a question, Frank. I know 4 gigapascals is a high pressure for experiments. It's really a very tiny pressure from the point of view of the material. Mm-hmm. Do you really think that you can go from a region of spin fluctuations to a region of charge fluctuations with such a tiny pressure change?
Yeah, that's what we find.
I mean, the electronic properties must change by a very small amount.
Yes, I admit we have to convince you by doing all these diffraction measurements and see that there's a value transition at this level in these systems as well.
The contour volume column is critical endpoint. This is one which ends at the lower end, so it's first order of high temperatures or first
No, no, at low temperatures.
So it's first order of low temperatures and then the upper.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
No, they see it at low temperature, they don't see it at higher temperature.
Okay, because it goes both
ways. No, right? Yeah, but I mean, comes up.
Where would it lie on this phase diagram?
Probably somewhere here.
And in the pure germanium system, where's the end point?
They unfortunately they did 10 Kelvin and room temperature.
I see.
So you see, experimentalists don't have so much time and money to do, but they should
so
have.
So it's gone. Lower than 10 Kelvin.
It's lower than room temperature. They found the first order transition at 10 Kelvin and didn't see it at room temperature.
I see. Okay. So it could be pretty high.
Below room temperature.
Yeah,
So we will do this for these samples more carefully.
So we're really going for a first order phase transition.
Yeah, it's a first order phase. I have it in my control.
But there should be a finite temperature critical point, I think that's what you're
saying. Yeah, right. There must be, because it's absent at room temperature. I'm sorry, this was a side result. I didn't want to spend too much time on it. Yeah, no, do it. No, go ahead. Let me just say, although we, after 25 years, he said, of research on this material, this is not the end of the story. There are a lot of, or some very interesting questions, open questions in CM copper silicon too, which have to be answered in the near future, I would say. And let me just say in 3 words what it is. One is hinting at some phase separation problem, similar to that which was discussed by Zach Fisk and David Pines on the 1-1 by analyzing the normal state properties of the 115. The second one is probably some hidden order, hidden under the A phase, because there's a striking discrepancy between the small order moment I showed you of at most a tenth of a new Bohr and a rather big jump at the onset of the A-phase transition in such AS-type samples, which hints at some 40% of the Fermi surface being gapped. And that doesn't fit together. So as if some other mechanism leads to the big entropy. And finally, there is evidence that also the lattice degrees of freedom may play some role in generating superconductivity, both in the low-pressure dome and in the high-pressure dome. But I have no time to go into this and switch gears here, but we can discuss this later.
Question?
Yeah.
So, two transparencies before, you had the number for the effective mass enhancement. Where in the phase diagram was it? That M star is 500.
Oh. This one. This comes out of the Zicknagel calculation. We have she has one fit parameter, which is the gamma of the Sommerfeld coefficient at low temperature. So,
but experimentally.
Oh yeah, the numbers 1 joule per Kelvin square. But Well, I don't know how she arrived at this number, but she uses as an input parameter in her treatment this measured value of gamma.
But isn't this enhanced both in the anti-ferromagnetic and?
Well, this is probably in the paramagnetic state. This Fermi surface which she calculated.
Isn't this Marson Cantor just means that they have this nearly parallel pieces of the Fermi circle, so dispersion is very small. Yeah.
But how heavy is the mass in the anti-ferromagnetic state?
It's in the experiment, that's really not a big difference. It's really not a big difference. You see, it's a tenth of a mu Bohr, and we don't understand this 40% gapping from the jump height. But the gammas in serum copper to silicon do scatter a lot. As I said, it's depending on the copper concentration, on the exact copper concentration. So the smallest values are something like 600 to 700, and the biggest one are 1,000, so in this range. Okay? Let's now switch gears and just come to quantum criticality, and of course, I don't have to talk about this view graph. Let me be very brief. Until a few years ago, quantum critical anomalies found in the heavy fermions have been exclusively treated within the Hertzsprung theory. So that's a spin fluctuation theory addressing anti-ferromagnetic paramagnons and quantum critical points. And it has then used and further developed by many others. Originally, the theory was devoted to 3D electron systems and transition metal systems. When applied to the heavy fermions, this theory makes a big simplification. It ignores the internal structure of the quasiparticles, so considers them itinerant 4F electrons, which exist well below TK, the Condor temperature, in the whole phase diagram. On either side of the critical point here. So the quasi-particles themselves are not part of the criticality in this theory. Here is, again, the same coupling constant I explained before, which measures the coupling between the localized states, the F states, with the conduction electrons. That's the valence electron orbital states of the ligand atoms. And that we can control experimentally by either applying pressure, external pressure, or internal chemical pressure by suitable chemical alloying or a magnetic field, as you'll see. And we know from experiment that in most of the cases, but not in all, in the air temperature here is vanishing continuously as a function of this external experimental parameter. Meaning here's an abundance of strong anti-ferromagnetic fluctuations of the magnetic order parameter, which is a staggered magnetization and which, within the theory, derives from the spin polarization of the system of the charge carriers. The charge carriers are assumed to undergo, within the theory, a recoupling and itinerant anti-ferromagnetic type of order as spin density wave order. They form the heavy lambda fermi liquid as strong coupling, and they are scattered off the quantum critical fluctuations. Critical fluctuations due to this continuous quantum phase transition, which, as you all know, can be described by a classical phase transition in higher dimensions. So these fluctuations, these quantum critical fluctuations, are paramagnon type fluctuations, long-lived, spatially extended. They mediate the interaction among the charge carriers and lead to these anomalous non-Fermi liquid phenomena that we can observe in wide parts of the phase diagram, especially to surprisingly high temperatures, as you have seen.
And what evidence is there that the region of lambda Fermi liquid actually collapses in these kinds of systems?
This is a schematic, okay. A schematic view. I think we have one or two systems where this comes close. I have to think about it. See, copper to silicon too is very complex from the outset. But now it doesn't come to my mind. This is a schematic view. It's your, it's a theory type of schematic phase.
Now I'm getting
well, but as I already mentioned, although this simple theory, which with this simplification, is apparently at least to explain the normal state anomalies of cerium copper to silicon too, and I would assume of many or even all of the other cerium-based non-fermi liquid superconnectors, theorists have come up with alternative models in the last few years, especially models in which the quasi-particles, which consist of a dominating local F-part and a mixture of itinerant conduction electron contributions, disintegrate at the quantum critical point. And one of these models is this locally critical or local moment scenario, which Piers and Jinyao have proposed in quite some different versions. And the starting point for these proposals was the discovery by Hilbert von Lüdenhausen's group, Almut Schröder et al., that in cerium copper 6 with 10% gold, where one is exactly at a quantum critical point, the critical fluctuations can be described by an unusual omega over T scaling law, which is independent of wave vector, meaning the most critical fluctuations here in cerium copper 6 gold are local in character rather than spatially extended as in the Hertzmiller scenario. So these colleagues have introduced a new low energy scale related to this crossover temperature between the Landau-Fermi liquid state that is formed by the composite fermions and the non-Fermi liquid state where the quasi-particles seem to break apart. So we would expect then that in such a scenario, we are sitting close to the critical point to observe in our experiments large F-derived fluctuating moments. In Jinyao's version, one could say there are two coinciding different quantum criticalities, type of quantum critical points, namely the new one with the local properties that is dominating the inelastic neutron scattering experiments apparently is coinciding with an ordinary magnetic and interferomagnetic quantum critical point with extended fluctuations. However, the ordering here is due to localized F states, is not the spin density wave state. But in the following, I'd like to introduce the terbium rhodium to silicon too, and I think you have discussed it here couple of times. Two of my colleagues were here. Philip Gegenwart gave a talk at the conference, and Silke Bühler-Paschen during the workshop a couple of weeks ago. So I don't want to repeat their results. But from Silke's talk, you may remember that it is very likely in this material that the quantum critical phenomena are due to fluctuations of the Fermi surface volume in this material, and from Philip's talk, you may remember that the underlying magnetic fluctuations in Jinyao's spirit are not two-dimensional interferomagnetic fluctuations, but rather ferromagnetic fluctuations, except for a very close vicinity of the quantum value point that he has told you.
When you say ferromagnetic fluctuations, can you really distinguish and say that fluctuations with some finite momentum, which is neither ferromagnetic nor antiferromagnetic, are not critical?
So we can discuss that also later, what Philip told here. We didn't do the, we don't have neutron data yet. So everything is more or less indirect. But I don't want to go into this. I am prepared for this, for the discussion. So let me just do my talk because we want to go to lunch.
No,
when you don't have
lunch,
well, we can. Well, we can discuss it. Okay. No. I don't need lunch. So let me just introduce the terbium rhodium silicon by starting with the phase diagram here on the left side, that's temperature versus magnetic field. And this color code means the exponent of the temperature power law dependence of the electrical resistivity. So red means the exponent is 1, non-Fermi liquid behavior. And you see in a big part of the phase diagram, this is non-Fermi liquid. Even here down to the lowest temperature, I should say the lowest temperature slightly above 20 millikelvin. So we cannot explore yet this low temperature part. That's why. So you see at zero field, we enter an interferromagnetically ordered state at a low nail temperature of 70 millikelvin. And you, the blue one is the T-square law. And you see that the phase boundary, the magnetic phase boundary, if you apply magnetic field, you suppress interferromagnetism here, you apply 6.6 kilohertz set for the field parallel to the C-axis. The C-axis is the half magnetic axis, and the phase boundary is rather sharp. It's from interferromagnetic to paramagnetic. In the above the critical field of 6.6 kilohertz that you see here also T square, that's a heavy Landau Fermi liquid state induced by the magnetic field. You see this broad wide crossover regime between Landau Fermi liquid and non-Fermi liquid. You also see that the crossover temperature roughly evolves linear in the magnetic field. You can suppress magnetic order, at least in principle, also already at zero magnetic field. And to this purpose, you have to expand the volume. To demagnetize in the terbium system, you have to apply negative pressure, expand the lattice. And that is again done by germanium doping on silicon side. And for this single crystal with a nominal germanium concentration of 5%, we were able to push the nail temperature from 70 millikelvin down to 20 millikelvin. You'll see it in the specific heat data later. So here in the susceptibility experiment or in the resistivity experiments, we don't see any magnetism down to the lowest temperature of 20 millikelvin.
And isn't the point that the field is directed along different axes as temperature?
Different field.
B parallel to C or B perpendicular.
So I should say here we have the field parallel to the EZ plane. And that means, so here the field is 6.6 kilohertz for the hard direction, and for the EZ plane, it's a factor of 11 smaller, so 600 ersted. And for the germanium dope, instead of 600, we have 270 ersted here. And you also see this wide crossover regime with the crossover temperature almost linear in the magnetic field. So you can see the differences between these two samples also in the inset, that the susceptibility with temperature, this little cusp here, signals the onset of interferromagnetic order in the undoped material, which is absent in the germanium doped sample. And for this germanium doped single crystal, I show you in the main part the inverse of the susceptibility on a linear temperature scale. And the most important observation made here is that at the lowest temperature, below 0.3 Kelvin, the data lie on a straight line, strictly on a straight line, follow Curie-Weiss law with a negative Weiss temperature indicating some type of interferromagnetic coupling. And I would guess most of the physics of the not well understood quantum criticality is hidden under this number, minus one, because it's not simply the magnetic coupling between the local moments that we can prove. And I guess it's an interferromagnetic coupling to the Fermi sink, so it's an effective conductor. But let's skip this here. Most important here is the slope of this is huge, and you get a size of the paramagnetic moment, 1.4 mu bor, if you take all the determinants into account. And that is almost the full moment of the ytterbium 3 plus ion in its crystal field double quantum. That's a ytterbium 3 plus, it's a J plus 7 half Hund-Wohl multiplet, and this is partially split by the tetragonal crystal field. And we know from many experiments, including inelastic neutron scattering, that the lowest lying doublet is well separated from the excited crystal field levels. In other words, here at these low temperatures, all of the ytterbiums are residing in this doublet ground state, and 1.4 MeV is about the full moment of this state. So no indication of condo screening at these low temperatures.
You say that chi to the minus one goes to steam to the power of roughly 3/4, but then when you write the next line, this is the low sort of temperature part.
Fit. This one.
When the next line is chi, which is chi to minus one, which is just
it's a clear line. So this dotted line, this that dotted line. I don't discuss this one
here. Okay.
But Philip, I think, has shown you that we have an unusual exponent, but it's better 0.6 than 0.75. That's an old U graph, so I didn't skip this here. This is because the other people group at 7.6 was 10% growing. They found this in their nice scaling, this exponent for the susceptibility and the dynamical susceptibility. But in our case, it seems to be scaled better by t to the minus 0.6 rather than 7.5. But I want to skip this.
I also assume that the exponent depends over which interval you scale.
So, I mean, I restrict the discussion to the low temperature part and strictly to the temperature below 0.3 Kelvin where we have a linear law. This is all I want to discuss. A very similar conclusion is drawn from ESR experiments. You see the ESR very sharp line here. This has a width of 0.02 tesla. And you have to compare it to the so-called Kondo field that is related to the Kondo temperature, which I will introduce in the next U graph. It's 25 Kelvin, so 37 tesla, which you could call a smearing field, which permits you in all the known heavy fermions to really observe an ESR line on the Kondo ion itself well below the Kondo temperature. What you do there is you take an ESR probe like gadolinium 3 plus, this is stable moment, that you put on the Kondo ion side, and then you can probe the electronic environment. That's what one usually does. But here, by comparing the intensity of this line with the uniform bulk susceptibility, and also by comparing the anisotropy of this line, which is shown here in the inset, with the anisotropy we know from the uniform susceptibility, we come to the conclusion this line is really due to the ytterbium 3 plus in the crystal field Raman study. It's the first ever observation of the sharp ESR line well below TK. So I owe you the TK. How do we get this scale, 25 Kelvin? So the first evidence came from the magnetic entropy, which I show you in the inset, which we get from the specific heat data. And let us, for a minute, discuss in the main part how I'm doing it.
Doing fine.
Okay, so let me speed up a little bit. This is again the Sommerfeld coefficient of the electronic specific heat. We have subtracted all the phonon parts and so on, and on a log scale. And what you see here at higher temperature, this broad hump is a Schottky, so-called Schottky hump, indicating the crystal field splitting of the localized 4F states, which I've mentioned of 70, 80 Kelvin. And I said that at low temperature, all of the ytterbiums are residing in that Farmer's doublet ground state. If we were dealing with the Landau-Fermi liquid state, then we should have some flat temperature-independent gamma. But what we see instead is this logarithmic increase on cooling setting in at about 10 Kelvin and going down to about 0.3 Kelvin, below which temperature the divergence becomes even stronger. And I'll discuss that later. And from these data, by a reasonable extrapolation of the data to t equal to zero, you get the magnetic entropy per formula unit. And you expect for a fully degenerate J equals 7.5 state that the data should give you R, L, and H. And you see the data show tendency towards saturation at this value at about room temperature. And there's another tendency towards saturation in R, L, and 2 you see in the temperature window, say 40 to 60 Kelvin, and that yields the first rough empirical measure for the condo temperature of the lowest line Fermat's doublet state, the effective spin 1/2
doublet. But how do you then understand this extraordinarily narrow ESR line given these numbers? And I mean, the entropy, if the line was so narrow, would be huge at that temperature. And yet your own curves show that the entropy is dropped down to quite a small value. It's a paradox, no?
Yeah, it's really a paradox.
Okay.
And there are many more, as you know.
Sorry, can you elaborate on the paradox?
Yeah, I agree.
Well, we just see the last few graphs, just in here to see. So the line width of the ESR signal is extraordinarily small. It's much smaller than.
So you have a full moment. Kelvin. You have a full moment, right. You ought to have a large entropy.
Yeah.
Paramagnetic moment.
If you
no
interpret this as a local moment response.
So, Pierce, that's what the experiments tell us. But I cannot answer that question. That's one of the really open questions.
I don't know enough about ESR. How do I...
There was a discussion about 3 weeks ago.
Well,
may I come to my next point?
Sure.
We're on the same line. I don't know enough either. But you may find that not convincing, this variation of pK from this curve. And more direct evidence is coming from the position of this extremely large thermal particle. In case of ytterbium, you expect a negative, and you see a gigantic negative thermal particle, minus 100 microvolt per Kelvin at exactly 25 Kelvin. Well separated from this broadened feature at high temperature, which again is apparently due to the crystal field system.
So there seems to be pretty good evidence that the first crystal level just above the lowest doublet is actually around 80 Kelvin.
Also. No, it's about 150 Kelvin. You always have this factor of 2 or 3.
On the order of 100
Kelvin. Yeah, it's between 100 and 200.
Okay. Yeah.
That agrees with our neutron.
Which is actually good to know, that there's a separation of the scales.
Although there's a big cone on hiding this peak in the neutron, so we have clear evidence for, you expect 4 doublets in J equals 7.5. And we do see the two highest excited doublets very well, but we assume that a big phonon is masking the second one at 150. So, what you see here is indicating that ytterbium, rhodium to silicon, assume you don't know anything. You start measuring at room temperature, cool down and stop at 10, 15 Kelvin. That looks like a vegetable, like an ordinary heavy fermion metal with some crystal field splitting and a condo temperature of the lowest lying doublet of the order 25 Kelvin. But now you continue cooling it down, and now all these paradoxes occur. It seems at low temperature as if the condo effect is not working or very badly working, as if the formation of the local condo singlets becomes imperfect. And the question is then, since we believe in the rare earth-based heavy fermions, the formation of the local condo singlets initiate the formation of these composite heavy quasi-particles, do we see anything which looks like disintegration, breakup of these composite fermions when we approach the quantum gradient point just by cooling? let us for this purpose compare the temperature dependencies of a thermodynamic property, the again the Sommerfeld coefficient in the electronic specific heat, plotted here on a log T scale, with the electric resistivity, the transport property, on a linear scale. And that's here for the 5% germanium doped sample. And here the lowest temperature is 10 millikelvin of this experiment. From the lowest temperature to even above 10 Kelvin, 12 Kelvin, over 3.5 decades, we see a nice linear temperature dependence of the resistivity. That is the prototypical non-thermal liquid phenomenon in, which we know, known from the optimally doped cuprates, where you see it over 2 decades, and where you don't have, as far as I understand, no idea what the origin is, because you don't know what kind of fluctuation or what the symmetry broken pseudo gap state or really is, whose fluctuations are responsible for that. Here we are pretty sure that we have to ascribe this to the quantum radial fluctuations associated with the continuous quantum phase transition, which at zero field we expect to lie at slightly higher germanium concentration than this nominal 5%. Well, you guys tell me, if you have a few independent self-energy, then this linear temperature dependence of the resistivity by some causality should go along with the logarithmic divergence of the Sommerfeld coefficient.
That's debatable.
Okay, but somebody of you, I forgot who, but Chandra told me about this. But you never denied it. So, from the last view graph, but I'm interested to learn. From the last view graph, you remember that this divergence, logarithmic divergence, sets in also at about 10 Kelvin, but it stops at 0.3. And at lower temperature, you see there's a stronger, there's some upturn in the data. And let's discuss only the paramagnetic state, namely the state above 100 millikelvin. You see the data lie on top of each other for two very different samples, magnetic-wise. The one having a near temperature of 70 millikelvin with a rather sharp jump in the specific heat data. And here's the evidence for the near temperature of 20 millikelvin. This is data down to 80 millikelvin in the specific heat with this very washed out, broad, small, tiny phase transition anomaly. So obviously this upturn here can't be due to some magnetic short-range order effects or critical fluctuations associated with the finite temperature phase transition. It is an intrinsic property, and again, due to the quantum radial fluctuations of the underlying quantum phase transition. Well, if we assume here at this point, as experimentalists, I must be careful, that by this thermodynamic property, Sommerfeld coefficient, we are mainly probing the dominating local 4S part of the composite fermions, while by the electrical resistivity, we are mainly probing the itinerant conduction electron part of the quasiparticles. We may conclude from these, this so-called disparate temperature dependence that the local 4F part is more sensitive to the nearby magnetic wire. You could also say the spin part of the quasiparticle is more sensitive to the nearby magnetic order than is the conduction electron part, and that this 4F part therefore is freed from the complex composite quasiparticles, and that we take as the indication of a breakdown. Of course it's dangerous to draw such conclusions just from temperature dependencies, from power loss and log T dependencies. They are best suggestive only. So we have to work a little bit more seriously on the analysis of our data, one way or the other. And of course we all believe if we have a critical point, there should be some scaling. So I'd like to show you some of the scaling properties of this material.
Do you have a question about that? Do you see any changes in the resistivity when it grows to the same temperature, about 0.3 Kelvin?
the red curve.
Not at all. And even here we see the under system in the high purity single crystals, we do see the ordering at 70 millikelvin. But here, we don't see it even at, I said, the lowest temperature is 10. We don't see it at 20 if you look carefully, because the residual resistivity of this sample, of the doped sample, is about 5 micron centimeter, and already tiny disorder weeps out the phase transition anomaly. Only in the very clean new generation of samples, in the undoped samples, can we see there. And we don't see anything at 0.3 Kelvin. So let's go into the scaling, or let me say we can shift entropy. We are able to shift entropy from this low temperature upturn region to elevated temperature just by applying a small DC magnetic field, and that is shown here. That leads to this broad maximum, and the position of this T naught is, as you see, increasing in temperature. If we increase the magnetic field, and what we find is that this scale T naught is directly proportional to the difference to the critical field. So this is the applied field, that's the critical field, and for this, as I said before, germanium doped single crystal with the field along the easy plane, it's a tiny number, 270 or almost zero. And that means since this scale vanishes at the field-induced bonding critical point at the critical field, that allows for some scaling, namely T over T naught, or T over the field difference scaling. And you see, if you scale the specific heat data over this abscissa here, T over the field difference, you can plot the temperature traces taking various applied magnetic fields all on top of each other. And this here marks the crossover from the non-thermoliquid to the lambda-thermoliquid state. And that has a nice side effect. There's no residual entropy at the quantum critical point. And that means you can really distinguish this scenario, this quantum critical scenario, from others which are used to explain non-thermoliquid behavior, notably all these quantum impurity models, these multi-channel condom models where you have residual entropy. Let us discuss a little bit this field-induced lambda-thermoliquid state. You see, if you decrease the field, if you approach the critical field from above, then the existence range of this lambda-thermoliquid state shrinks, and at the same time, the plateau value, I call it gamma naught, is increasing. And we have plotted this here, gamma naught, as a function of this field difference on a log scale, and at elevated fields, do we find some logarithmic divergence, as is shown by, I think, Paul and Kotlia, is expected in the spin density wave scenario for strictly two-dimensional fluctuations. But below 0.3 tesla, there's a stronger upturn here as a function of field difference, which we can nicely fit by a power law that's an exponent 1/3. And that is then in strong contradiction to the spin density wave model. And you see, this reminds us, this field dependence at very low temperature reminds us of the temperature dependence at low field or at the critical field. What I have discussed before were zero field data. That's the black points. And you see above 40, 50 millikelvin, the black and the red data points lie on top of each other. It's only below 40 millikelvin that the zero field data adopt higher values. So you do see the critical fluctuations associated with the finite temperature phase transition at 20 millikelvin at very low temperature. The intrinsic quantum critical behavior, which we see at high temperature, is nicely continuing at the quantum critical point, namely at an implied field of 250 Earths, which is very close to the critical value. So that is the intrinsic behavior, and that we can fit by a power logarithm quantum constant.
Just for clarification, if you feed the data in the whole interval between, say, 0.1 Kelvin and few Kelvin, ST to minus 1/3, do you see a clear deviation from the data at high temperatures? In other words, is there any range where logarithm?
I remember we see some deviation, but I forgot the details. Jerome Kapsas did that. And I also forgot where it occurred. But above 1 Kelvin, certainly. Yeah.
But is it fair to say that one can, to some approximation, claim that specific heat coefficient basically scales as t to minus 1/3?
No, I would say it turns over from this logarithmic dependence to this power law dependence roughly at 0.3. But I don't know where it stops. But somewhere here, the fit is first. I admit I forgot this. We have it at home. So you see, this exponent is the same at low temperature as a function of field, or at the critical point as a function of temperature. And interestingly enough, the same symmetry is found if we look at the resistivity data. I showed you that the electrical resistivity in zero field follows a linear T law over a wide range down to the lowest temperature. And that means the A coefficient of the T squared term, which is proportional to the quasi-particle scattering cross section, scales as 1 over T. Or the inverse of this A coefficient evolves proportional to T. And this holds for zero field, but it holds also for this very tiny critical field. There's no difference in the data between zero field and this critical field. So we would expect then, if we had the same symmetry here in the data, that 1 over A should evolve like B. And this has in fact been found. Here we have applied the field both parallel to the easy plane, parallel to the hot direction. That's a factor of 10, 11 is the correct factor, and you see roughly this divergence at this very tiny critical field here. And we also can arrive at some universality in the data. Here we take the temperature derivative of the resistivity and use the same abscissa, T over the field difference, and more or less the data fall on top of each other for various applied magnetic fields. So, summarize at that point, from the divergence of the Sommerfeld coefficient and the A coefficient of the T squared term, we conclude first or that the effective mass and star proportional to the Sommerfeld coefficient and the scattering cross section both become singular on the whole family surface. That's very important. But secondly, from the universalities we find, we can say if we are at the quantum critical point, say in the temperature magnetic phase diagram, and we go away from the quantum critical point, say vertically, by just increasing the temperature, it's only the temperature which determines the evolution of specific heat and the resistivity, or if we at the lowest temperature, at zero temperature, move away by increasing the field, it is the magnetic field that sets the scale for the variation of these properties. At that point, I should have included the Hall data of the Hüller function, but as I said, I'm prepared to discuss it later. Let me turn to my last experiment I want to discuss, namely measurement of the Grünhausen parameter. The Grünhausen parameter, or Grünhausen ratio here, is proportional, it's a ratio of the thermal expansion and the volume thermal expansion and the specific heat. Two thermodynamic properties which can explore the quantum critical point in the temperature pressure phase diagram in quite complementary ways. You know that This one is related to the temperature, and this one to the pressure derivative of the entropy. If you do the measurement, you find if you measure specific heat C or thermal expansion beta as a function of temperature, there are two contributions in your data. One is a normal contribution proportional to temperature. It's a lambda Fermi liquid contribution. And that you have to subtract from the data. And then you get the critical contributions due to the quantum critical fluctuations. And their ratio is called the Grünheisen ratio. Usually you call it the Grünheisen parameter, but my colleagues here have used the Grünheisen ratio because they restricted on these critical contributions. And they have come out with a very interesting result, namely that this Grünheisen ratio necessarily has to diverge as a function of temperature at any quantum critical point, so a necessary condition for a quantum critical point. And if you are able to describe the data by a power law, then you learn from the scaling exponent more about the nature of this quantum critical point. So we have checked this theoretical prediction first with serum nickel 2 germanium 2, and that's the first ever observation of such a diverging quantum critical Grünheisen ratio. And you see the divergence is 1 over t, so the exponent is 1, and that is exactly what comes out for the Hertz-Millis, the spin density based in our three-dimensional critical fluctuations. And we have also checked ytterbium rhodium to silicon to doped germanium, and also find a divergence. The Grünheisen, the thermal expansion is necessarily negative for an ytterbium system, so it's a negative Grünheisen ratio. And that's a double log plot. And again, 0.3 Kelvin, we are able to describe the data by a power law. And the exponent is smaller than 1. It's a fractional exponent, close to 2/3. And as what I was told by Qingyao, this is what he gets for an XY type interferomagnetic fluctuating system. Yeah.
If you consider separately beta and C over T, you show that the C over T scales as T to minus 1/3. What happens with beta? In other words, whether this exponent X is mostly due to divergence of specific heat coefficient or beta's plethora.
Yeah. It's also complicated. In serum nickel 2 germanium 2, the specific heat also shows an upturn in the data. And this upturn I mentioned earlier has probably nothing to do with quantum critical behavior, maybe indication of phase separation. And we are just doing this by lanthanum doping. So we have subtracted this little upturn in the data, but it's not affecting the data very much. The rest is a square root of T. It's a square root of T divergence so gamma naught minus square root of T. That's the somatic coefficient, C over T. And the thermal expansion you can then calculate.
I was asking about the difference between 1 and 0.7.
Oh, this one.
This difference is mostly due to this power minus 1/3 that you showed before, or there's something else involved. In other words, is this another indication of this power minus 1/3 that you showed that before, or something new?
I think it's both 1/3.
I think the dominant temperature dependence comes actually from the specific heat.
And the specific heat?
That is just another way to say the behavior.
Yeah. But the thing is that it's easier to understand this exponent on X, which is just some scaling dimension of some operator, rather than operator. It's much harder to construct a theory for the specific heat. So at some point it becomes semantics.
Okay.
Anyway, this is all what I wanted to show. Let me then come to my last thing. I tried to convince you that in case of serum carbide silicon too, the quantum critical point is of this conventional spin density wave type, the three-dimensional critical fluctuations. And of course, this supports the frequently adopted view of Per-Mangon mediated superconductivity in the heavy fermion superconductor. Although in this material we had found striking evidence also for another type of pairing mechanism, namely due to charge fluctuations near a potential valence transition at high pressure. And as I mentioned briefly, we at present time can even not rule out that the lattice degrees of freedom are playing some role in generating Cooper pairs in this material. So more than just one order coupling mechanism acting together, that might be a characteristic property of unconventional superconnectors evolving from strongly correlated electron systems. I think that's a very interesting point for future research. Despite all these open questions, it seems to me plausible to assume, it's my working hypothesis at least at the moment, that in most, if not in all, of the serum-based heavy fermion non-fermi liquid superconnectors, one is dealing with a nearby quantum critical point of the Hertz-Mills type conventional type.
First of all,
please.
The resistivity that you mentioned had a T to the 3 half
behavior. Yeah.
And if you're naive, you think about a 3D stimulant available with respect to T squared. Why would that be compatible with this?
No. I mean, the Hertz-Mills and Moria theories all get 3 half.
In the, without disorder, it should be T squared if it's anti-formal transition.
At extremely low temperature, it might be. You're right. Yeah, sure.
No, I just want to see.
Okay. But in the accessible temperature range. And as Achim also has shown it, there's. Anyway, and it may even be that in the 115s, I'm not an expert in the 115s, you may even have two-dimensional Hertz-Mills type quantum criticality also in some of them. But there's a big difference to a terbium-rhodium facility and the germanium-deuterium. The quantum criticality really is of an unconventional type, which we have derived from the observation of very large, almost non-condo stream fluctuating moments at very low temperature. You remember the Curie-Weiss law set in at 0.3 Kelvin and was followed down to 20 millikelvin. That's 10 to the minus 2 or less of decay where you would expect the moments to be fully condo stream. We have also found disparate temperature dependencies in the thermodynamic and transport properties when we approach the quantum critical point. I did not discuss the destruction of the Fermi surface, of the large Fermi surface of at the quantum, an abrupt jump in the linear response Hall coefficient at zero temperature. But I showed you this fractional exponent in the greenhouse. Interestingly enough, this material is not a superconductor. And that holds true for serum copper 6 with 10% gold too. There, of course, people argue that 10% gold is too much of this order for an unconventional, highly anisotropic superconductor. This excuse doesn't work anymore for a terbium-rhodium to silicon too, because in the cleanest new generation of single crystals, we have extremely high quality. Their residual resistivity is now less than 1 micron centimeter. That's a factor of 3 to 4 better or lower than in the best samples of Gehlonsreutz on xeon palladium to silicon.
Does the resistivity still go linear, 25, all the way down?
All the way down.
We want to see that.
Well, I can only show you 10 millikelvin, but I'm in discussion with the people in Garching. They have a two-stage copper demagnetization, and we want to see how the upturn in the gamma in the Sommerfeld coefficient evolves. I think we can approach 1 millikelvin in 1 year.
That's
sort. So, but maybe we can. So, no superconducting. Question is, how should we think about that? The simplest way would be to say, well, if you want to form Cooper pairs, you need well-defined quasi-particles. Otherwise, you don't get Cooper pairs. Maybe that's too simple. But also, perhaps, these ferromagnetic quantum critical fluctuations play an important role and prevent superconducting. That has to be explored in the future. So my present working hypothesis then is the following. And hypothesis. A conventional spin density wave, one critical point, somehow favors unconventional superconductivity. Unconventional, at least in two respects. One, I mentioned that the order parameter is highly anisotropic, namely has a symmetry less than the Fermi surface underlying the normal state, but also unconventional in another sense, that the Cooper pairs are not mediated by well-defined bosonic excitations with well-defined dispersion relations, but hereby overdamped ferromagnets. While the unconventional quantum viewpoint, by some reasons, detrimental to superconductivity, and that's with that I want to close.
Great. Very minor current, but even in more conventional cases, the pairing is still mediated by overdamped spin fluctuation. There are no such thing as pairing mediated by spin waves. It just can't.
Oh, in uranium, palladium, two, aluminum, three, we are convinced. I mean, they are all damped. But
all damped.
It's real magnons. Yeah. That be proved by inelastic neutrons.
But my question is more about the stars that you put in. One of them. Most striking result that you showed was linear resistivity.
Mm-hmm.
The stretch is basically from the lowest temperature and extends
right.
up to
right.
say 10 Kelvin. Right. All the story about fractional exponent and dependence of Grignard ratio, as far as I understand, is a story below 1 Kelvin.
It's below 0.3.
Below 0.3 Kelvin. At the same time, linear resistivity is a phenomenon that extends in a much
goes down and goes down to the.
Am I right that if you measure Grignard ratio above 0.3 Kelvin, you will get exponent 1, which still will
we'll
be...
See. Well, we have it. Let me see. Please. So you see, it's still smaller. That's 1. And
yeah, but it's kind of...
We are, here you see, maybe here.
Yeah. That's 1
yeah.
Kelvin there.
Yeah.
It's 1 Kelvin there. It's still linear at 1 Kelvin
yeah.
upwards. Right?
But then it bends over and...
In other words, I'm trying to say that it looks to me that there are two phenomena here. One is linear resistivity that extends
mm-hmm.
to a
mm-hmm.
large range of frequencies.
Mm-hmm.
And second, there is extra phenomena that you see, say, below either 0.3 or 1 Kelvin, that
right,
you say,
right.
which is corresponds
right.
to a non-logarithmic behavior of physics.
Yeah, right. But the resistivity still shows the
linear.
Yeah. That's your right.
Well,
this is the
can just tell my
dad. No, can you just say that you can reproduce that to 1 microcentimeter and still see the linear curve. It's still minor correction to residual resistivity. So it's, if you take Achim Roche's story, this is what comes out all the time.
No. I mean for strictly linear he doesn't get it. I think it does not get strictly linear temperature.
So
it gets 1.1 or 1.2. And
but your linear, in your best samples, you now see linear from 10 Kelvin
to 10
all the way down,
to 10
and you have 1 micron instead
yeah,
of linear.
Less than 1 micron. Yeah.
And still the same overall change.
Same overall change.
We'd like to see those curves. We want to see those curves.
But of course, maybe in the microcarbon regime.
Oh, sure,
so,
but nevertheless.
Yeah. Okay.
Can I say something about this? I mean, I think the Grignard ratio at higher temperature is something to be understood. The one thing one can say for sure is that it's not well achieved.
Well,
the exponent is much, much weaker than
that. Well, let's say, I think that what this data show is that, as Purdish said, linear resistivity. That is the same at high temperature and extends down to low temperature,
plus extra behavior that we see below one, below whatever. And it's not shown up in resistivity.
Yeah.
So I don't see how Grignard ratio is related to linear resistivity.
It's not SDW,
that's
the
one conclusion.
Okay,
we'll
agree with that.
Victor has a question. Yeah, I'd like to ask
about... Me also.
No.
About the shapes of the Fermi surfaces. You showed us one example, this band structure compilation, one material.
Mm-hmm.
But what about the other materials? Do they have same kind of Fermi? Or what is known about the shapes?
Nothing.
No. Should we have the Haas or anything?
No, the Haas van Alphen yet. We are planning when Philip comes back from Andrews, Andy's group in Andrews. We will try the Haas van Alphen.
We
did some recently.
With four or five bands crossing Fermi surfaces.
Many bands, yeah.
So do people, you know,
well,
believe,
I don't know whether you really could compare Gertrud's and Mike's results, because this is LDA, while she is a little bit more devoted, and I think she puts in the right phase shift.
Oh, so she has a Fermi surface for Italian
She has not yet.
That's what I
mean.
Could you please comment on your point regarding strongly developed ferromagnetic fluctuations at Mitterrand motor interceptors? What is the experimental evidence?
Yeah.
We're going to have to wrap up soon because of the colloquium.
Oh. Haven't you heard Philip's talk here during the conference?
Oh,
you did not.
That's why it's good to listen to the whole thing.
I need to score the big
one. So this is his first results. You see in the uniform sensitivity, that's AC sensitivity measurements, above 0.3, again, 0.3, you see this P to the power minus 0.6 behavior. And then it deviates, and as you see in the inset, below 0.3, Kelvin or so. And in fields up to 0.05 Tesla here, these three lines, you have this curly lines behavior. So the curves are bending over. And then you see that at higher fields, there's a maximum which is from upwards in fields and a flat poly like low temperature behavior setting in. So both the peak position, that is meant the if you plot the magnetization as a function of field for a given temperature, then in this regime, the MDD is more sensitive against variations of the magnetic field. And both the peak position as also this temperature where the poly flat part sets in, which is always lower than the peak position, shift upwards in field. Well, here's shown the flat chi naught, the polysensitivity, I guess, which are the points. This is the triangles here, and the initial part of the magnetization. That's the black dots. And you see down to about 0.02 or 0.02. 0.03 Tesla, you find a divergence as a function of field difference, again with the same power law, 0.06, and then it deviates because of the onset of the curly wise at lower fields. And you also see clearly that this divergence here is stronger than that of the Sommerfeld coefficient. And that, of course, yields a very large Sommerfeld-Gerson ratio. That I guess it's shown here. Forget about the Kadowaki Woods, that doesn't play any role. Here the Sommerfeld-Wilson ratio, that's dimensionless. You have to normalize by the effective moment of the crystal-field doublet bronzing, and so on. Already at elevated temperature, you have a rather high number, 17 or so. But then it starts diverging and overshoots 30 at the lowest field. And there's always the field difference. So below 0.02 tesla or so, then susceptibility becomes flat, and this part, and now we come to the phase diagram. Here in the inset is shown, let me go here. Below 0.3 Kelvin, this hatched area is the regime where you find the Curie-Weiss law. Below 0.3 Kelvin and above 0.05 tesla, that's the field without the subtraction of the critical field, below 0.05 tesla, you have the Curie-Weiss law. This is the line for these maxima, and you see you have ferromagnetic polarization here, and these are the data. So all this was done on the germanium dog sample, but he included here in this phase diagram, that's the small dark points, the data on the undoped material. So these ferromagnetic polarization, this is independent of germanium dog, quite different to the interferromagnetic order. I showed you the nil temperature goes down by a factor of 3, the critical field also, but the ferromagnetic polarization does not. So let me summarize here. If we go in zero magnetic field, here down, and measure susceptibility, we find an unusual non-Fermi liquid behavior. And we find the same symmetry in the exponents if we go in the Landau-Fermi liquid state and approach the critical point by decreasing the magnetic field that is shown here. Yeah. So we have, like in this regime, what I discussed before, we have a temperature dependence in the non-Fermi liquid field-free regime, and compared with the power law of the Landau-Fermi liquid regime by approaching the quantum critical point and find the same exponent, and the same is here for these ferromagnetic fluctuations. And you see that these crossover lines here, this line above which we have the ferromagnetic fluctuations, quantum critical fluctuations, and the line above which we have non-Fermi liquid behavior, or below which Landau-Fermi liquid sets in, they do not extrapolate to the same endpoint at t equal to zero. The ferromagnetic line polarization ends at 2 times the critical field, namely this field 0.05 tesla roughly, that is here, while the other line, the Landau-Fermi liquid line, ends at the quantum critical point at the critical field, that's 0.027. So they cross there. So that's the experimental evidence from Philip's recent paper.
I think at this point probably deserves some more lengthy discussion, but just one remark to see whether we agree or not. It seems to me that the word ferromagnetic polarized only has heuristic meaning, because the line really just reflects that the susceptibility has a peak at that temperature, right? And the magnetization is not suddenly showing either full polarization by any stretch. All that is shown is that for the parallel magnet, for the field in AB plane, M versus the magnetic field has a little bit of kink.
And the sum of it, the Wilson ratio is so large.
Yeah, no, that's real. But that's everywhere in the face, not just confined to the.
Well, this, the Sommerfeld-Wilson ratio, if you come very close here to the quantum critical point, goes down, because the susceptibility becomes flat, and the specific heat coefficient seems to diverge, really. So we didn't plot that, and I don't think we have enough measurements, but I assume that the Sommerfeld-Wilson ratio goes down.
I see.
Okay.
Well, Frank is going to be here the rest of the week, and I want to encourage everyone to talk to him. Thank you much.